Mudge and John Tom turned down a well-trod path into the woods.
Interesting character, your sorcerer.
Not my sorcerer, mate.
A brightly feathered lizard pecked at some banana-like fruit dangling from a nearby tree.
Have another chocolate coin?
No, thanks.
Speaking of coins, that little sack of silver he gave you might as well be turned over to me for safekeeping, since you're under my protection.
That's all right.
John Tom patted the pocket in which the coins reposed.
It's safe enough with me, I think. Besides, my pockets are a lot higher than yours. Harder to pick.
Instead of being insulted, the otter clapped a furry paw on John Tom's lower back.
Oh, maybe you're less the fool than you seem, mate. Frost me if I don't think we'll make a decent animal out of you yet.
Aren't you the least bit curious about this great crisis Clotherhump was referring to?
Gosh, that's probably just a figment of his sorceral imagination. I've heard tell plenty about what such chaps drink and smoke when they feel the mood. They calls it wizardly speculating. Me? I calls it getting well stoked. Besides, why dwell on crises, real or imagined, when one can have so much fun from day to day?
You should study the thread of history.
You talk like that in Lynchpenny, and you will have trouble, mate. Thread of history now, is it? Sure you won't trust me with that silver?
John Tom simply smiled.
Ah, well then.
Any last lingering thoughts that it might all still be a nightmare from which he'd soon awake were forever dispelled when they'd come within a mile of Lynchpenny, following several days' march. John Tom couldn't see it yet. It lay over another rise and beyond a dense grove of pines, but he could clearly smell it. The aroma of hundreds of animal bodies basking in the warmth of mid-morning could not be mistaken.
Something wrong, mate.
Mudge stretched away the last of his previous night's rest.
You look a touch bilious.
Oh, that stink.
We're near Lynchpenny, like I promised.
You mean that stench is normal?
Mudge's black nose frisked the air.
No. I'd call her a mite weak today. Wait until noontime, when the sun is at its highest. Then it'll be normal.
You have great wizards like Clotherhump. Haven't any of them discovered the formula for deodorant?
What's that, mate? Another of your incomprehensible otherworldly devices?
It keeps you from smelling offensive.
No, you do have some queer notions in the other worlds. How are you to know your enemies if you can't smell them? And no friend can smell offensive. That'd be a contradiction, do it not? If he was offensive, he wouldn't be a friend. Of course, you humans have always been pretty scent poor. I suppose you'd think it good if people had no scent at all.
It wouldn't be such a bad idea.
Well, don't go propounding your bizarre religious beliefs in Lynchpenny, Gov. Or even with me to defend you, you won't last out the day. No scent. No more sweet perfumes of friends and ladies to enjoy. Sure, I'd rather be blind than unable to smell, mate. What senses do they use in your world, anyway?
The usual ones. Sight, hearing, touch, taste, and smell.
And you'd wish away a fifth of all your perception of the universe for some crazed theological theory?
It has nothing to do with theology. It's a question of etiquette.
Piss on your etiquette. No greeting smells. I don't think I'd care to visit long in your world, John Tom. But we're almost there. Mind you keep control of your expressions. You hold your nose to someone and they'll likely spill your guts for you.
John Tom nodded reluctantly.
Take a few deep breaths, just take a few deep breaths, and you'll soon be used to it.
They topped the little hill and were suddenly gazing across treetops at the town. At the same time, the full ripeness of it struck him. The thick musk was like a barnyard sweltering in a swamp. He was hard-pressed not to heave the contents of his stomach out the wrong orifice.
Yeah, now, don't you go be sick all over me. Brace up, lad. You'll soon be enjoying it.
They started down the hill, the otter trotting easily, John Tom staggering and trying to keep his face blank. Shortly, they encountered a sight which simultaneously shoved all thought of vomiting aside while reminding him this was a dangerous, barely civilized world he'd been dragged into. It was a body, similar to, but different from Mudge's. It had its paws tied behind its back and its legs strapped together. The head hung at an angle, signifying a neatly snapped neck. It was quite naked.
Odd how quickly the idea of clothing on an animal grows in one's mind.
Some kind of liquid resin or plastic completely encased the body. The eyes were mercifully closed, and the expression not pleasant to look upon. A sign lettered in strange script hung on a post driven into the ground beneath the dangling, preserved corpse. He turned questioningly to Mudge.
That's the founder of the town.
John Tom's eyes clung to the grotesque monument as they strolled around it.
Do they always hang the founders of towns around here?
Not usually. Only under special circumstances. That's the corpse of old Tylo Binney. Ought to be getting on a couple hundred years old now.
That body's been hanging there like that for hundreds of years?
Oh, he's well preserved, he is. Local wizard embalmed him nice and proper.
That's barbaric!
Well, as it goes, old Tylo there, he's a ferret, you see. And they come a no good line to start with. He was a confidence man. Fleeced farmers hereabouts for years and years, taking their money most of the time and their daughters on occasion. Well, a bunch of them finally gets onto him. He'd been buying grain from one farmer, selling it to another, borrowing the money and buying more. It finally came to a head when a couple of his former customers found out that a lot of the grain they'd been buying afore existed only in Tylo's head. They gets together, cornering him in this here grove, and strings him up neat. At that point, a couple of travelling craftsmen, woodworker and a silversmith, I think, or maybe one was a cobbler, decided that this here valley, with its easy water, would be a nice place to start a crafts guild, and the town sort of grew up around it. When folks from elsewhere wanted to locate the craftsmen, everyone around told them to go to the place where they'd lynched Benny, the confidence ferret. Hence the name. And, if you hadn't noticed yet, Gov, you're breathing right easy now.
Much to John Tom's surprise, the queasiness had receded.
You're right. It's not so bad anymore.
Ah, that's good. You stick near to me, mate, and watch yourself. Some of the local bully boys like to toy with strangers, and you're stranger than most. Not that I'd be afraid to remonstrate with any of them, mind now.
They were leaving the shade of the forest. Mudge gestured ahead. His voice was full of provincial pride.
There she be, John Tom. Lynch Bennytown.
No fairy spires or pennant-studded towers here.
John Tom gazed at the village. No rainbow battlements, no thin, cloud-piercing turrets inlaid with gold, silver, and precious gems. Lynchbinney was a community built to be lived in, not looked at. Clearly, its inhabitants knew no more of Moorish palaces and peacock-patrolled gardens than did John Tom. Hemmed in by forests, the buildings and streets meandered down a narrow valley. A stream, barely a yard wide, trickled through the town center. It divided the main street, which, like most of the side streets he could see, was paved with cobblestones shifted here from some distant riverbed. Only the narrow creek channel itself was unpaved. They continued down the path, which turned to cobblestone as it came abreast of the rushing water. Despite his determination to keep his true feelings inside, the fresh nausea that greeted him as they reached the first buildings generated unwholesome wrinkles on his face. It was evident that the little stream served as community sewer, as well as the likely source of potable water. He reminded himself firmly not to drink anything in Lynchbinney unless it was bottled or boiled. Around them rose houses three, sometimes four, stories tall. Sharp-peaked roofs were plated with huge foot-square shingles of wood or gray slate. Windows turned translucent eyes on the street from second and third floors. An occasional balcony projected out over the street. Fourth floors and still higher attics displayed rounded entrances open to the air. Thick logs were set below each circular doorway. Round windows framed many of these aerial portals. They were obviously home to the arboreal inhabitants of the town, cousins of the red-breasted, foul-mouthed public servant they met delivering mail to Clothahump's tree. The little canyon was neither very deep nor particularly narrow, but the houses still crowded together like children in a dark room. A few flew pennants from poles set in their street-facing sides or from the crests of sharply gabled rooftops. They could have been family crests or signals or advertisements. John Tom had no idea. More readily identifiable banners in the form of some extraordinary washing hung from lines strung over narrow alleyways. He tried to identify the shape of the owners from the position and length of the arms and legs, but was defeated by the variety. At the moment, furry arms and hands worked from upper floor windows, hastily pulling laundry off the lines amid much muttering and grumbling in reaction to the thunder which rumbled through the town, echoing off the cobblestone streets and the damp walls of cut rock and thick wooden beams. Each building was constructed for solidity, a small home put together as strongly as a castle. Shutters clapped hollowly against bracings as dwellers sealed their residences against the approaching storm. Smoke, ashy and pungent, borne by an occasional gust of wet wind, drifted down to man and otter. A glance overhead showed dark clouds clotting like black cream. The first raindrops slapped at his skin. Mudge increased his pace and John Tom hurried to keep up. He was too fascinated by the town to ask where they were rushing to, sufficiently absorbed in his surroundings not to notice the isolated stares of other hurrying pedestrians. After another couple of blocks, he finally grew aware of the attention they were drawing.
It's your size, mate.
As they hurried on, John Tom took time to look back at the citizens staring at him. None stood taller than Mudge. Most were between 4 and 5 feet tall. It did not make him feel superior. Instead, he felt incredibly awkward and out of place. He drew equally curious stares from the occasional human he passed. All the locals were similarly clad, allowing for personal differences in taste and station. Silk, wool, cotton, and leather appeared to be the principal materials. Shirts, blouses, vests, and pants often sported beads and feathers. An astonishing variety of hats were worn, from wide-brimmed 17th-century style feathered to tiny, simple berets, to feathered peaked caps like Mudge's. Boots alternated with sandals on feet of varying size. He later learned one had a choice between warm, filthy boots or chilly but easily cleanable sandals. Keeping clean could be a full-time trial. They crossed the main street just in time to avoid a pre-storm deluge when an irritable and whitened old possum dumped out a bucket of slops from a second-floor porch into the central stream, barely missing the pair below.
Hey, watch it!
Now what?
That wasn't very considerate.
Stranger and stranger sound your customs, Gov. Now what else is she supposed to do with the household night soil?
With a hand, he traced the winding course of the steady stream that flowed through the center of the street.
This time of the year it rains here nigh every day. The rain washes the soil into the central flue here, and the stream packs it off right proper.
John Tom gave fervent thanks he hadn't appeared in this land in summertime.
It wasn't her action I was yelling about, it was her aim. Damned if I don't think she was trying to hit us.
Now that be a thought, mate. But when you're as dried up and housebound as that faded old sow, I expect you grab at every chance for amusement you can.
What about common courtesy?
Rely on that if you want to die young, says I. Watch out now.
They moved to one side of the street and leaned up against a shuttered storefront. A huge double wagon lumbered toward them, one trailing behind another. The vehicle required nearly the entire width of the street for passage. John Tom regarded it with interest. The haggard, dripping driver was a Margay. The little tiger cat's bright eyes flashed beneath the wide-brimmed, floppy felt hat he wore. Behind him, riding the second half of the wagon, was a squirrel no more than 3 feet tall. He held his tail curled over his head, providing extra protection from the now steadily falling rain. He struggled to tug heavy canvas or leather sheets over the cargo of fruits and vegetables. 4 broad-shouldered lizards pulled the double wagon. They were colored iridescent blue and green, and in the gloom, their startlingly pink eyes shone like motorcycle taillights. They swayed constantly from side to side, demanding unvarying attention from their driver. Momentarily generating a louder rumble than the isolated bursts of thunder, the enormous wagon slid on past and turned a difficult far corner.
I've no sympathy for the chap who doesn't know his business.
They continued on their way, hugging the sides of buildings in search of some protection from the downpour.
That lot ought long since to have been undercover.
As the rain continued, most of the windows had been closed or shuttered. The darkness made the buildings appear to be leaning over the street. They hurried on, sprinting from one rickety wooden porch covering to the next. Once, they paused in the sheltering lee of what might have been a bookstore. Scroll store, rather, since it was filled with ceiling-high wooden shelves punched out like a massive wine rack. Each hole held its thick roll of paper. As Mudge had indicated, the rain was washing the filth from the cobblestones, and the now swollen central creek carried it efficiently away. The front moved through, and the thunder faded. Instead of the heavy driving rain, the clouds settled down to shedding a steady drizzle. The temperature had dropped, and John Tom shivered in his drenched t-shirt and jeans.
Begging your pardon, sir.
John Tom uncrossed his arms.
What?
He looked to his right. The source of the voice lay in a narrow alley barely large enough to allow two people to pass without turning sideways. A gibbon lay huddled beneath a slight overhang, curled protectively against several large wooden barrels filled with trash. His fuzzy face was shielded by several large scraps of wrapping paper wound together and tied with a knot beneath his chin. His crude hat hung limp in the rain. Badly ripped trousers of some thin cotton material covered the hairy legs. He wore no shirt. Long arms enfolded the shivering chest, and large circular sores showed where the hair had fallen out. One eye socket was a dark little hollow. A delicately fingered hand extended hopefully in John Tom's direction.
A silver piece, sir. For one unlucky in war and unluckier still in peacetime. It was a bad upbringing and a misinformed judiciary that cost me this eye, sir. Now I exist only on the sufferance of others.
John Tom stood and gaped at the pitiful creature.
A few coppers then, sir, if you've no silver to give.
Suddenly he shrank back, falling against the protective trash cans. One fell over, spilling shreds of paper, bones, and other recognizable detritus into the alley. Dimensional dislocation does not eliminate the universality of garbage.
Night, I meant no harm.
Mudge stood alongside John Tom. The otter's sword was halfway clear of its chest scabbard.
I'll not have you bothering this gentleman while he's in my care.
He took another step forward.
Maybe you mean no harm, and maybe you do. But you'll do none while I'm about.
Take it easy. Can't you see he's sick?
Sick be the word, all right. Do you not know how to treat beggars, mate?
He pulled on his sword.
I do.
John Tom reached into his pocket, felt for the small linen purse Clothahump gave him. He withdrew a small coin and tossed it to the gibbon. The simian scrambled among the stones and trash for it.
Oh, blessings on you, sir. Heaven kiss you.
Mudge turned away, disgustedly sliding his sword back in place.
Waste of money.
He put a hand on John Tom's arm.
Come on, then. Let's get you to the shop I have in mind before you spend yourself broke. It's a hard world, mate, and you'd better learn that soonest. You never saw the blighter's knife, I take it?
Knife? What knife?
John Tom felt queasy.
Aye, what knife indeed. If I hadn't been with you, you'd have found out what knife. But I guess you can't help yourself. Your brains being up that high, I expect they thin out along with the air. What knife?
He stopped and glared up at the dazed John Tom.
Now, if it were up to me, mate, I'd let you make as much of the idiot of yourself as you seem to have a mind to. But I can't risk offending his wizardship, see. So until I've seen you safely set up in the world and on your own way to where I think you might be able to take some care for yourself, you'll do me the courtesy from now on of taking my advice. And if you'll not think of yourself, then have some pity for me. Mind the threats that Clothahump put on me.
He shook his head, turned, and started down the street again.
Me, who was unlucky enough to trip over you when you tripped into my day.
Yeah? What about me, then? You think I like it here? You think I like you, you fuzz-faced little fart?
To John Tom's dismay, Mudge smiled instead of going for his sword.
Now, that's more like it, mate. That's a better attitude than giving away your money. god-rotted, stinking layabout trash as soon split your gut as piss on you. Do you wonder I like it better in the forest, mate?
Mudge pushed on the door of a shop.
Oh, mind your head now, John Tom.
His tall companion took note of the warning and bowed under the eave. The interior of the shop had the smell of leather and lavender. They saw no one. Several chairs with curved seats and backs stood arranged neatly near the center of the floor. Long poles supported cross racks where clothing lay draped.
Oi, proprietor! Show yourself and your work!
And work you shall have, my dear whoever you are's.
The reply issued from the back of the shop.
Work only of the finest quality and best stitchery, of the toughest materials and prettiest...
The fox had come to a halt, staring past Mudge at the dripping, lanky shape of John Tom. Silk slippers clad the owner's feet. He wore a silk dressing gown with four matching ribbons of bright aquamarine. They ran around his tail in intersecting loops to meet in a bow at the white tip. He also wore a practical-looking belt from which protruded rulers, marking sticks, several pieces of dark green stone, and various other instruments of the tailor's craft.
What is that?
He gestured hesitantly at John Tom.
That's the work we're chatting about, and a job it's going to be, I'd wager.
Mudge flopped down in one of the low-slung chairs with complete disregard for the upholstery and the fact that he was dripping wet. He put both short legs over one arm of the chair and pushed his feathered cap back on his forehead.
Off to it now, that's a good fella.
The fox put both paws on hips and stared intently at the otter.
I do not clothe monsters. I have created attire for some of the best-dressed citizens in Lynchbony and beyond. I have made clothing for Madame Scorianza and her best girls, for the banker Flouston Wolf, for members of the town council, and for our most prominent merchants and craftsmen. But I do not clothe monsters.
Mudge leaned over in the chair and helped himself to a long, thin stick from a nearby tall glass filled with them.
Look on it as a challenge, mate.
He used a tiny flinted sparker to light the stick.
Listen, I don't want to cause any trouble.
The fox took a wary step backward as that towering form moved nearer.
Mudge here thinks that...
He was indicating the otter, who was puffing contentedly on the thin stick. Smoke filled the room with a delightfully familiar aroma.
Say, you suppose I could have one of those, sticks?
For the convenience of the customers, lad.
Mudge magnanimously passed over a stick along with his sparker. John Tom couldn't see how it worked, but at this point was more than willing to believe it had been treated with a good fire spell. Several long puffs on the glowing stick more than relaxed him. Not everything in this world was as horrible as it seemed, he decided. It was smoking that had made him accessible to the questing thoughts of Clotherhump. Perhaps smoking would let something send him home. 10 minutes later, he no longer cared. Reassured by both Mudge and the giant's dreamy responses, the grumbling fox was measuring John Tom as the latter lay quite contentedly on the carpeted floor. Mudge lay next to him, the two of them considerably higher mentally than physically. The tailor, whose name was Carlamont, did not object to their puffing, which indicated either an ample supply of the powerful smoke sticks, a fine sense of public relations, or both. He left them eventually, returning several hours later to find Otter and Man totally bombed. They still lay on the floor and were currently speculating with great interest on the intricacies of the wormholes in the wooden ceiling. It was only later that John Tom had recovered sufficiently for a dressing. When he finally saw himself in the mirror, the shock shoved aside quite a bit of the haze.
Oh, my.
The indigo silk shirt felt like cool mist against his skin. It was tucked neatly into straight-legged pants, a cross between denim and flannel. Both pants and shirt secured with matching buttons of black leather. The jet leather vest was fringed around the bottom and decorated with glass beadwork. The cuffs of the pants carried a similar fringe, though he couldn't tell this at first because they were stuffed into calf-high black leather boots with rolled tops. At first it seemed surprising that the tailor managed to find any footgear at all to fit him, considering his size compared to the average local human. Then it occurred to him many of the inhabitants likely had feet larger in proportion to their bodies than did men. A belt of metal links, silver or pewter, held up the pants. They shone in sharp contrast to the beautifully iridescent hip-length cape of some green lizard leather. A pair of delicate but functional silver clips held the cape together at the collar. Despite Mudge's insistence, however, he categorically refused to don the orange tri-cornered cap.
I just don't like hats.
Such a pity. It really is necessary to complete the overall effect, which, if I may be permitted to say so, is striking as well as unique.
John Tom turned and watched the scales of the cape flare even in the dim light.
Sure as hell would turn heads in L.A.
Not bad. Almost worth the price.
Almost, indeed.
The fox paced around John Tom, inspecting the costume for any defects or tears. Once he paused to snip a loose thread from a sleeve of the shirt.
It is subdued, yet flamboyant. Attention-gathering without being obtrusive.
He smiled, displaying sharp teeth in a long, narrow snout.
The man looks like a noble, or better still, a banker. When one is confronted with so much territory to cover, the task is at first daunting. However, the more one has to work with, the more gratifying the end results. Never mind this plebeian, my tall friend. What is your opinion?
I like it, especially the cape.
He spun a small circle, nearly fell down, but recovered poise and balance nicely.
I always wanted to wear a cape.
I am pleased.
The tailor appeared to be waiting for something.
Ahem.
Crikey, mate. Pay the fella.
Some good-natured haggling followed, with Mudge's task made the more difficult by the fact that John Tom kept siding with the tailor. A reasonable balance was still struck, since Carlamont's natural tendency to drive a hard bargain was somewhat muted by the pleasure he'd received from accomplishing so difficult a job. That did not keep Mudge from chastising John Tom as they left the shop behind. The drizzle had become a heavy mist around them.
Mate, I can't save you much if you're going to take the side of the shopkeeper.
Don't worry about it.
For the first time in a long while, he felt almost happy. Between the lingering effects of the smoke session and the gallant appearance he felt positive his new attire gave him, his mood was downright expansive.
It was a tough task for him, and he did a hell of a job. I don't begrudge him the money. Besides,
he jingled the purse in his pocket.
We still have some left.
That's good, because we've one more stop to make.
Another? I don't need any more clothing.
That's so. Far as I'm concerned, mate, you're walking around bloody naked.
He turned right. They passed four or five storefronts on the wide street, crossed the cobblestones and a little bridge arcing over the central stream, and entered another shop. It possessed an entirely different ambiance from the warm tailor shop they'd just left. While the fox's establishment had been spotless, soft-looking, and comfortable as an old den, this one was chill, with an air of distasteful business. One entire wall held a selection of devices designed for throwing. John Tom saw dozens of knives, ellipsoidal, stiletto, triangular, with or without blood gutters, grooved nastily in their flanks, gem-encrusted little pig stickers for argumentative ladies, trick knives concealed in eyeglass cases or boot soles, all the deadly variety of which the honer could manufacture. Some of the swords and throwing knives had grooved or hollow handles. A hand would not make much use of such grips, but they were perfect for, say, a flexible wingtip. For a few high moments at the tailor's, John Tom managed to forget this was a world of established violence and quick death. He leaned over the counter, barring the back of the shop from the front, and studied something that resembled a razor-edged frisbee. He looked around for Mudge and found him returning from the back, chatting with the owner. The squat, muscular raccoon wore only an apron, sandals, and a red headband with two feathers sticking downward past his left ear. He smelled, as did the back of the shop, of coal smoke and steel.
So, this is the one who wants the mayhem?
The raccoon pursed his lips, looking over his black nose at John Tom.
Mudge, I don't know about this. I've always been a talker, not a fighter.
I understand, mate, but there are weighty arguments, and there are weighty arguments.
He hefted a large mace to further illustrate his point.
Leastwise, you don't have to employ none of these tickle-me-tights. but you bloody well better show something, or you'll mark yourself as an easy target. Now, can you use any of these toys?
John Tom examined the bewildering array of dismembering machinery.
I don't...
Tis plain to see he's no experience. Let me see now. With his size and reach...
He moved to a wall where pikes and spears grew like iron wheat from the floor, each set in its individual socket in the wooden planks. His right paw rubbed at his nose. With both hands, he removed an axe with a blade the size of his head.
Where skill and subtlety are absent, mayhap it'll be best to make use of the other extremes. No combat or weapons training at all, young lad.
John Tom shook his head.
What about sports?
I'm not bad at basketball. Pretty good jump shot, and I
what
can...
What the devil's arse is that? Does it perhaps involve some hitting?
Not much. Mostly running and jumping, quick movements.
Well, that's something. Perhaps a toy less bull bright than that meat cleaver you're holding, then. What would you recommend, Armorer?
A fast retreat?
The Armorer turned dourly to another rack, preening his whiskers.
Though, if the man can lay honest claim to some nimbleness, there ought to be something.
He put up the massive axe.
Mayhap we can give him some help.
He removed what looked like a simple spear made from the polished limb of a tree, but instead of a spear point, the upper end widened into a thick wooden knob with bumps and dull points. It was taller than Mudge and reached John Tom's ears, the shaft some 2 inches in diameter.
Just a club?
'Tis the longest thing I've got in the shop.
The armorer dragged his clipped nail down the shaft.
This is ramwood. Won't snap in a fight. With your friend's long reach, he can use it to fend off an opponent if he's not much interested in properly disposing of him. And if things get tight and he's still bloodshy, why, well, a good clop on the head with the business end of this will make someone just as dead as if you split his skull. Not as messy as the axe, but just as effective.
He handed it to the reluctant John Tom.
Make your fine walking stick too, man. And there's something else. I mentioned giving you some help.
He pointed at the middle of the staff. Halfway up the shaft were 2 bands of inlaid silver 3 inches apart. The space between was decorated with 4 silver studs.
Press any one of those, man.
John Tom did. The staff instantly grew another foot. 12 inches of steel spike now projected from the base of the staff. John Tom was so surprised he almost dropped the weapon. Mudge danced about like a kid in a candy shop.
Bugger me, mother, if that ain't a proper surprise for any discourteous dumb butt you might meet in the street. A little rub from that'll cure him right quick, I venture.
Hey, just tap him on the toe and press your release, and I guarantee you'll see one fine, wide-eyed expression.
John Tom pushed down on the shaft, and the spear spike retracted like a cat's claw up inside the staff. Another experimental grip on the studs, and it shot out once more. It was clever, but certainly not amusing.
Listen, I'd rather not fool with this thing at all, but if you insist...
I do!
Mudge wiped tears from his eyes.
I do insist. Like the master armorer here says, you don't have to use that toe chopper if you've no mind to, but there'll likely be times when you'll want to keep some sword-swinging sot a fair few feet from your guts. So take claim to it and be glad.
John Tom hefted the shaft, but he wasn't glad. Merely having possession of the weapon depressed him. Outside, they examined the contents of the little purse. It was nearly empty. A few small silver coins gleamed forlornly like fish in a dark tank from the bottom of the sack. John Tom wondered if he hadn't been slightly profligate with Clothahump's generosity. Mudge appraised the remnants of their fortune. Mist continued to dampen them, softening the lamplight that buttered the street and shop fronts. With the easing of the rain, other pedestrians had reappeared. Animal shadow shapes moved dimly through the fog.
Hungry, mate?
Starving.
Me too.
He clapped John Tom on his cape.
Now you look almost like a real person.
He leaned close.
Now, I know a place where the silver we have left will bring us as fat a feast as a pregnant hare could wish. Maybe even enough to fill your attenuated belly hollow. Maybe some entertainment besides. You and I have done our duty for the day, we have.
As they strolled further into town, they encountered more pedestrians. An occasional wagon jounced down the street, and individuals on saddled riding lizards hopped or ran past. Two young squirrels scampered by. One finally tackled the other. They tumbled to the cobblestones, rolling over and over, punching and kicking, while a small mob of other youngsters gathered around and urged them on. To John Tom's dismay, their initial cuteness was muted by the manner in which they gouged and scratched at each other. Not that his own hometown was devoid of violence, but it seemed to be a way of life here. One cub finally got the other down and was assiduously making pulp of his face. His peers applauded enthusiastically.
Is this a way of life here?
A way of life, mate? I wouldn't know. I'm no philosopher now, but I know this. You can be polite and dead, or respected and breathing. You can make your own choice. Just don't be too ready to put aside that nice new toy you've bought.
John Tom made sure he had a good grip on the staff. The increasing crowd and lifting of the fog brought fresh stares. Mudge assured him it was only on account of his unusual size. If anything, he was now clad far better than the average citizen of Lynchbunny Town. But his stomach remained empty.
Not much longer, mate.
They turned into an almost hidden entrance on their left, into which Mudge urged him. Once again, he had to bend nearly double to clear the overhang. Then he was able to stand. The ceiling inside was a good 2 feet above his head, for which he was more than slightly grateful.
The Pearl Possum. Me? One for something liquid now. This way, mate. Beware the lamps.
8 feet inside the entrance, the ceiling curved upward like a circus tent. It peaked a good 2.5 stories above the floor. Beneath this central height stood a circular counter dispensing food and brew, manned by a small battalion of cooks and mixologists, including a couple of weasels. What tables he could see spotted the floor like fat toadstools in no particular order. On the far side of the Pearl Possum stood partially enclosed booths designed for discussion or dalliance, depending on the inclination of the inhabitants. They continued to make their way through the noisy, malodorous crowd. Isolated ponds of liquor littered the floor, along with several splinters from smashed wooden mugs. The owners sensibly disdained the use of glass. Numerous drains pockmarked the wooden planking underfoot. Occasionally, someone would appear with a bucket of water to wash down a section of the floor, too slippery with booze, sometimes of the partially digested variety. John Tom stood easily the tallest man, the tallest animal, in the room, though there were a couple of large wolves and cats who were built more massively. It made him feel only a little more confident.
Here, lad, over here!
Oh, whoa!
John Tom felt himself yanked down to a small but abandoned table. His knees pressed up toward his chest. The chairs were much too low for comfortable seating. Furry bodies pressed close on all sides, filling his nostrils with the stink of liquor and musk. Supporting the table was the sculpted plaster figure of a coquettishly posed female opossum. It had been scratched and engraved with so many lewd comments that the sheen was almost gone. Somehow a waiter noticed that their hands and table were empty and shoved his way through to them. Like the armorer, he wore an apron, only this one was filthy beyond recognition, the pattern beneath obliterated by grease and other stains. Like the armorer, he was a black-masked raccoon. One ear looked badly mangled, and a white scar ran boldly from the ear down the side of his head, just past the eye, and on through the muzzle, but particularly noticeable where it crossed the black mask. John Tom was too busy observing the life and action swirling around them to notice that Mudge had already ordered.
Not to worry, mate. I ordered for you.
I hope you ordered food as well as liquor. I'm hungrier than ever.
Oh, that I have, mate. Any fool knows 'tis not good to drink on an empty belly. Here, watch yourself.
Two large wooden mugs of something highly carbonated and smelling of alcohol arrived. The hardwood mug looked oversized in Mudge's tiny hand, but it was just the right size for John Tom. He tried a sip of the black liquid, found it to be a powerful fermented brew, something like a highly alcoholic malt liquor. He determined to treat it respectfully. The waiter's other hand deposited a large platter covered by a badly dented and scratched metal dome. When the dome came off, a wonderfully rich aroma filled John Tom's nose. On the platter lay all kinds of vegetables. Among strange shapes were comfortingly familiar carrots, radishes, celery, and tiny onions. A raft of potatoes supported a huge cylindrical roast. A single center bone showed at either end. It was burnt black outside and shaded to pink near the bone. John Tom glanced from their table to others nearby.
What do we eat with? No silverware?
Look at this crowd. You think the management wants to put more weapons in their hands?
The otter had a hunting knife out. It was short and triangular like the tooth of a white shark and went easily through the meat.
Rare, medium, or well burnt?
Anything.
Mudge sliced off two respectable discs of meat and passed one to his companion. They ate as quietly as smacking lips and gravy-slick fingers would permit. John Tom struggled to keep the juice off his freshly cut clothes. Mudge was not nearly so fastidious. Gravy ran down his furry chin onto his vest and was sopped up by vest and chest fur. They were halfway full when a partially sated John Tom relaxed long enough to notice that in addition to the center bone running through the roast, there were thin, curving ribs running from the bone to meat like the points of calipers near the bottom.
Mudge, what kind of meat is this?
Not tasty enough, mate.
It's delicious, but I don't recognize the cut or the flavor. It's not any kind of steak, is it? I mean, beef?
Beef? You mean cattle? Oh, no. They may not be smart, but we're not cannibals here, we're not. Of course, it ain't king snake, but it ain't bad. Python, reticulated, I'd say.
Wonderful. Why be squeamish in the face of good taste? After all, meat is meat. It's all muscle fiber to the teeth. Still, I wouldn't want to meet a snake that size away from the dinner plate.
Later, he leaned back in the short chair and picked at his teeth with a splinter of the table, as he'd seen some of the other patrons doing.
Well, that may be the last of our money, but that's the best meal I've had in years.
Alright, not bad.
Mudge had his short legs up on the table, the boot heels resting indifferently in the pastry tray. He leaned across the table, feeling warm and serious. He put a cautionary paw on John Tom's wrist.
Sorry to shatter your contentment, mate, but we've something else to talk on. Clotherhump charged me with seeing to your well-being, and I've a mind to see the job through to the end. If you want to continue eating like that, we're gonna have to find you some way to make a living, what?
Reality churned in John Tom's stomach, mixed unpleasantly with the pastry.
Can we just go back to Clotherhump?
He decided he was beginning to like this world.
Not if he don't get that gold spell, right? Keep in mind that as nice and kindly as the old bugger seemed a few days ago, wizards can be god-rotten temperamental. If we go back already and pester him for money, he's not gonna feel much proud of you. Not to mention what his opinion of me would be. You wanna keep the old twit feeling responsible for what he's done to you, mate? We might have a fair supply of silver tucked away neat and pretty somewhere, but his supply of silver is bound to be limited. So long as he's got his feeble old mind set on this dotty crisis of his, he's not going to be doing much business. No business, no silver. No silver, no handouts, right? I'm afraid you're just going to have to go to work.
I see. What about working with you, Mudge?
Now, don't get me wrong, mate. I'm just getting to where I can tolerate your company.
Thanks.
That's all right. But hunting's a solitary profession. I don't think I could do much for you there. You don't strike me as the type of chap who knows his way around the woods. You'd as soon trip over a trap as set one, I think.
I won't deny that I feel more at home around books or a basketball court.
Otherworldly sports won't do you ants piss good around here, lad. As far as the learning part of it. What was it then you were acquiring?
I'm into pre-law, Mudge.
A barrister to be, is it? Never had much use for the species myself. What did you study besides the law itself? For the laws here, as you might imagine, are likely a mite different from those of your own.
History, government? I don't think there'll be much use here either.
I suppose we might get you apprenticed to some local barrister. I don't know, mate. You certain there's nothing else? You ever work a forge, build furniture, do metalwork, build a house, cure meat? Anything useful?
Not really.
Huh. Fine life you've led for a so-called wizard.
That's Claw the Hump's mistake. I never claimed to be that. I never claimed to be anything other than what I am.
Which don't appear to be much as far as placing is concerned. Nothing more in the way of skills, is it?
Well, I'm not helpless. I don't want to keep imposing on you, Mudge. Take this place. I'm not afraid of hard work. There must be hundreds of mugs and platters to wash, and floors to be mopped down, tables to be cleaned, drains to be scoured. There's a hell of a lot of work here. I could...
Mudge reached across the table and had both paws digging into John Tom's indigo shirt. He stared up into the other's surprise.
You can't do that. That's work for mice and rats. Don't let anyone hear you talk like that, John Tom.
He let go of the silk and sat back in his chair.
Come on now, work is work.
Think you that now?
Mudge pointed to his right. Two tables away from theirs was a rat about 3 feet tall. He was dressed in overalls sewn from some heavy, thick material, badly stained and darkened. Thick gloves covered tiny paws, and knee-high boots rested on the floor as the rodent scrubbed at the planking. The others nearby completely ignored his presence, dropping bones or other garbage nearby, or sometimes onto his back. As John Tom watched, the rodent accidentally stumbled across the leg of a drunken gull hunting a table with perches to accommodate ornithological clients. The big bird cocked a glazed eye at him and snapped once with its beak, more taunting than threatening. Stumbling clear, the rat fell backward, tripped over his own feet, and brought his bucket of trash and goo down on himself. It ran down his boots and over the protective overalls. For a moment, he lay stunned in the heap of garbage. Then he slowly struggled to his knees and began silently gathering it up again. He ignored, but seemed not necessarily oblivious to the catcalls and insults the patrons heaped on him. A thick bone bounced off his neck, and he gathered it up along with the rest of the debris. Soon the watchers grew bored with the momentary diversion and returned to their drinking, eating, and arguing.
Only rats and mice do that kind of work? I used to do something like that all the time. Remember, that's what confused Claw the Hump into bringing him here in the first place.
What you do elsewhere, you'd best not try here, mate. Any self-respecting animal would sooner starve before doing that, or go to begging like our sticker-eyed friend the gibbon.
I don't understand any of this, Mudge.
Don't try to, mate. Just roll with the waves, what? Besides, those types are naturally lazy and dumb. They'd rather lie about and guzzle cheese all day than do any honest work, they would. Spend all their time when not eating in indiscriminate screwing, though you wouldn't think they'd have enough brains to know which end to work with.
John Tom fought to control his temper.
There's nothing wrong with doing menial work. It doesn't make those who do it menial-minded. I guess I just thought things would be different here as far as that kind of thing goes. It's my fault. I was imagining a world that doesn't exist.
Little while back, I recall you insisting that this one didn't exist.
Oh, it exists, all right.
John Tom's fists rubbed angrily on the table as he watched the subservient rat suddenly fall down, landing on his chest. A turtle with a disposition considerably less refined than Claw the Hump's had stuck out a stubby leg and tripped the unfortunate rodent. Once more, the laboriously gathered garbage went flying, while a new burst of merriment flared from the onlookers.
Why discrimination like that here? Why here too?
Discrimination? Nobody discriminates against them. It's all they're good for. Can't argue with natural law, mate.
John Tom had expected more from Mudge, though he had no real reason to. From what he'd already seen, the otter was no worse than the average inhabitant of this stinking, backward non-paradise.
There ain't nothing you can do about it, mate. Why would anyone want to change things? Mopping and sweeping and such are out, unless you want to lose all respect due to a regular citizen. politicking you're also qualified for. But that, of course, ranks even lower than janitorial-type drudgery. And I hope you won't have to fall back on your abilities for minstreling. Now, old Clotherhump, he was bloody well sure you were some sort of sorcerer, he was. Are you sure you can't work no magic? I heard you questioning his wizardship's own special words.
That was just curiosity, Mudge. Some of the words were familiar, but not in the way he used them. Even you did the business with the dancing pins. Does everyone practice magic around here?
Everyone practices all right. But few get good enough at it to do much more than a trick or two. Pins are my limit, I'm afraid. Wish to hell I knew his gold spell.
His gaze suddenly moved left, and he grinned broadly.
Of course now, when the situation arises, I ain't too bad at certain forms of levitation.
His right hand moved with the speed of which only otters are capable. How the saucily dressed and heavily made-up chipmunk managed to keep from dumping the contents of the 6 tankards she was maneuvering through the crowd was a bit of magic in itself, John Tom thought, as he ducked to avoid the few flying suds. She turned an outraged look on the innocent-seeming Mudge.
You keep your hands to yourself, you shit-eating son of a mudworm! Next time you'll get one of these tankards up your furry backside!
Now, Lily, haven't you always told me you're always hunting for a way to move up in the world?
She started to swing an armful of liquor at him, and he cowered away in mock fear, covering his face with his paws and still smiling. Then she thought better of wasting the brew. Turning from their table, she marched away, elbowing a path through the crowd. Her tail switched prettily from side to side, the short dress barely reaching from waist to knee. It was gold with a gray lining that neatly set off her own attractive russet and black and white striping.
What did I tell you, mate?
Mudge grinned over his mug at John Tom. He tried to smile back, aware that the otter was trying to break the glum mood into which John Tom had fallen. So he forced himself to continue the joke.
Mighty short levitation, Mudge. I don't see how it does her any good.
Who said anything about her?
The otter jabbed himself in the chest with a thumb.
It's me the levitating benefits.
The thick, warm atmosphere of the restaurant combined with the rich food and drink to make John Tom decidedly woozy. Determinedly, he shoved the mug away, arose, and glanced around.
What be you searching for now, mate?
Some of my own kind.
His eyes scanned the crowd for the sight of bare flesh.
What? Humans? Well... Never have I understood your peculiar affinity for each other's company, but you're free enough to choose your own. Espy some, do you?
John Tom's gaze settled on a pair of familiar bald faces in a booth near the rear of the room.
There's a couple over that way. 2 men, I think.
As you will, then.
He turned his attention down to the otter.
It's not that I'm not enjoying your company, Mudge. It's just that I'd like my own kind to talk to for a while.
His worries were groundless. Mudge was in entirely too good a mood to be offended by anything.
Whatever you like, mate. We'll go and have a chat then, if that's what you want. But don't forget we've still the little matter of settling you on some proper course of employment. Minstrel. I don't know. There might still be the novelty factor.
He scratched the fur just under his chin.
Tell you what. Give us a song, and then we'll go over and see if we can't make the acquaintance of those chaps.
John Tom sat down again and considered.
I don't know. What would you like to hear?
How about ballads? Everyone likes ballads.
He thought, but it was hard to settle on any one song. He felt unnatural singing without his trusty worn Grundig slung over his shoulder and across his stomach.
Come on now, mate. Surely you can think of something.
I'll try.
There were 3 ravens sat on a tree. Down a down, hey down a down. And they were black as they might be with a down.
He launched into Strawberry Fair, but the delicate harmonies drowned beneath the bellowing, hooting, and whistling that filled the air of the restaurant. A sharp blow struck him between the shoulder blades and sent him sprawling chest down across the table.
What the...
He turned to find himself staring into a ferocious dark brown face set on a stocky, muscular body as tall as Mudge's but more than twice as broad. The snakeskin beret and red bandana did nothing to lessen the Wolverine's intimidating appearance.
Sorry.
The face glared down at him, powerful jaws parting to reveal sharp teeth as the lips curled back.
You're not sorry enough, I think. I've been pretty sorry for your mother. She happened to listen to a voice like that. You upset my friends and my meal.
I was just practicing.
John Tom was beginning to feel a mite indignant at the insults. The warmth of the roast was still with him. He failed to notice the queasy expression on Mudge's face.
It's difficult to sing without any music to accompany me.
Well, you can't practice no more, you hear? It hurts my ears.
Mudge tried and failed to gain John Tom's attention. John Tom rose to his feet to tower over the shorter but more massive animal. It made him feel better, giving proof once again to the old adage about the higher, the mightier. Or as the old philosopher said, witness the pigeon's tactical advantage over man. However, the Wolverine was not impressed. He gazed appraisingly up and down John Tom's length.
Oh, that voice too, but no voice. Maybe you better at singing in harmony, yeah? So maybe I put one half neck here and the other half across the table.
Powerful clawed hands reached for John Tom's face. Dodging nimbly, John Tom slipped around the table, brought up his staff, and swung the straight end down in a whistling arc. Having had plenty to consume himself, the Wolverine reacted more slowly than usual. He did not quite get both hands up in time to defend himself, and the staff smacked sharply over one set of knuckles.
Look, I don't want any trouble.
You stick up for your rights, mate.
Mudge urged him on as he made a precipitous retreat from the vicinity of the table.
I'll watch and make sure it be a fair fight.
Like hell you will.
John Tom held the staff tightly, trying to divide his attention between the Wolverine and the otter.
You remember what Claw the Hump said.
Screw that.
But Mudge hesitated, his hand fumbling in the vicinity of his chest sword. He stood sizing up the tense triangle formed around the table, debating whether or not he stood a better chance of surviving Clothahump's vengeful spellmaking or the Wolverine and his friends. The latter consisted of a tall marten and a chunky armadillo who displayed a sword hanging from each hip belt. Of course, carrying weapons and knowing how to use them were two different matters. They rose and moved to flank the Wolverine while gazing at John Tom in a decidedly unfriendly manner. The Wolverine himself had regained his composure and slid an ugly-looking mace from the loop on his own belt.
Steady on, mate!
The otter stood, sword out and committed now.
Maybe I've been wrong about that harmony.
He eyed the man's throat.
Maybe I can eliminate that voice altogether, yeah? It's too crowded in here, though. I think I meet you outside, okay?
Okay.
John Tom moved as if to leave, got his right hand under the edge of the table, and heaved. Table, drinks, remnants of their greasy meal and platterware showered down on the Wolverine, his companions, and several unsuspecting occupants of other tables. The innocent bystanders took exception to the barrage. One of the Wolverine's associates sidestepped the flying table and jabbed his sword at the otter's face. Mudge ducked under the marten's thrust and kept his sword ready to challenge the emerging armadillo while neatly kicking the bellicose marten in the nuts. The stricken animal grabbed himself and went to his knees. General mayhem threatened to involve everyone in the establishment. Only the chefs and bartenders kept their calm. They remained invulnerable behind their protective circular counter, defending liquor and food as assiduously as they had the honor and person of their gleaming white star performer. Only when some stumbling battler intruded on their territorial circle did their heavy clubs come into play. Waiters and waitresses huddled behind this front line of defense, casually making book on the outcome of the fight or downing drinks intended for otherwise occupied patrons. The fight whirlpooled around this central bastion of calm as the room was filled with yelps and meows, squeaks and squeals, and chirps of pain and outrage. It was an arboreal that almost got John Tom. He was effectively, if unartistically, using his long staff to fend off the short sword thrusts of an outraged Pika when he heard Mudge yell,
John Tom, da!
As it was, the bola-wielding mallard missed his neck but got his weapon entangled in the club end of John Tom's staff. He shoved down hard on it. John Tom had time to note the duck's kilt of orange and green. He wondered if the different kilt colors signified species or some sort of genus-spanning clan equivalent. There was little time for sociological contemplation. The Martin had recovered from Mudge's low blow and was moving to put the sharp edge of his blade through John Tom's midsection. Instinctively, he tilted the staff crosswise. The club end came over and around. It missed the agile Martin, but the entangled bird's bola caught around the weasel's neck. Dropping his sword, he pulled the device free of the staff and stumbled away, fighting to free his neck from the strangling cord. John Tom, momentarily clear of the attackers, hunted through the crowd for his companion. Mudd was close by, kicking furniture into the way of potential assailants, throwing mugs and other eating utensils at them whenever possible, avoiding hand-to-hand combat wherever he could. John Tom took no pride, felt no pleasure in his newfound capacity for violent self-defense. In vain, he looked across the milling crest of the fight for the entrance. It seemed a mile away, across an ocean of battling fur and steel. That left only the windows, an idea the panting Mudge quickly quashed.
Blimey, mate, you must be daft! That glass be half an inch thick in places and thicker where it's beveled. I'd sooner take a sword thrust than slice myself the bloody ribbons on that. There be an alley out back. Let's make our way in that direction.
I don't see any doors there.
Surely there's a service entryway. I'll settle down for a garbage chute.
Sure enough, they eventually discovered a single low doorway hidden by stacks of crates and piles of garbage. The close-packed mob made progress difficult, but they forced their way slowly toward the promise of freedom and safety. John Tom watched as a cape-clad coyote picked over the unconscious form of a badly bleeding fox. His attention thus diverted, something grabbed his left arm. He turned to swing the staff one-handed, or jab, as was required. The figure that grabbed him stood swathed in maroon and blue material. He could discern little of the figure, save that the mostly hidden face seemed to be human. The short figure tugged hard and urged him back behind a temporary wall formed by a trio of fat porcupines, who, for self-evident reasons, had little trouble fending off any combatant foolish enough to come close. John Tom decided there would be time later for questions, since the figure pulled him toward the haven promised by the back door, his intended destination anyway.
Hurry it up! The cops have been called and should be here any second!
That's fair warning, mate, and we'd best get out of here or die trying!
Why? What will they do?
He swung his staff in a short arc, brought up beneath the chin of a small but gamely threatening muskrat who was swinging at John Tom's ankles with a weapon like a scythe. John Tom knocked him out.
Do they kill people here for fighting in public?
Worse than that.
Mudge was nearly at the back door, fighting to keep potential antagonists out of sword range and the invulnerable porcupines between himself and the rest of the mob.
Quickly! Quick now, for your lives! They're here!
From his position, head and shoulders high, above the crowd, John Tom could see across to the now distant main entrance. He also noted with concern that the chefs and bartenders and waiters had vanished, abandoning their stock to the crowd. Four or five figures of indeterminate furry cast stood inside the entryway now. They wore leathern bonnets decorated with flashing ovals of metal. Emblems on shoulder vests glinted in the light from the remaining intact lamps and the windows. The crash indicated that apparently the appearance of the police frightened one of the fighters into following a chair out through a thick window pane. John Tom wondered what horrible fate lay in store for the rest of the still battling mob. Then he was following the strange figure and Mudge out through the door. As they turned to slam it behind them and bar it with barrels, he had a last glimpse across the room as the police took action against the combatants within. Those actions were accompanied by the smell of something awful beyond imagining and concentrated beyond the power of man or beast to endure. It weakened him so badly that he barely had strength enough to heave his not-yet-digested dinner all over the far wall. It helped his pride, if not his stomach, to see that the momentary smell had produced the same effect on Mudge and the maroon-clad stranger. As he knelt in the alley and emptied his guts, the pattern he'd glimpsed on the arriving police came back to him. Black fur with a white stripe down the center of the back.
Spellsinger is continued on the next CD.